live. Welcome back to The Unknown Pod. My name is Jordan Bush. I'm the executive director of TGFB Media, which exists to help Christians understand and use Bitcoin for the glory of God and the good of people everywhere. Today, you might be thinking to yourself, wait, there's supposed to be more Mountain Presbys. And that is, you are right. If you're thinking that, you are right. We are one Tim down. We are one teaching elder down. We are also an Iowan boy down. So Oshawa is off gallivanting around the Pacific Northwest. Tim, who knows what he's doing? Probably reading a book.
He's lost in the heavenlies.
Lost in the heavenlies. Listen, there's worse places to be lost. Jim, welcome. Introduce yourself for those who are unfamiliar with your glorious work.
My name is Jim McAndrew. I'm the drone lord. I run dronelink.com.
Let's go.
But I also am tech support at Magnolia, which serves to orange pill the church and Jesus pill Bitcoiners.
Let's go. Now, Jim, normally we don't give away free ads, but please enlighten the folks on what DroneLink is and does.
DroneLink is flight automation software for your DJI drone. So this is non-military use cases. You can do everything from have it follow you while you're skiing down a mountain to take a bunch of pictures of a cell phone tower for a 3D model.
Jim has repeatedly told the government to kick rocks rather than give them, sign a contract with them. So that's why part of why we love him. And he won't give it over to Palantir. He's content to refuse their moose shekels and eagle shekels.
I'm like the good version of Palmer Lucky.
That's right. Palmer Unlucky. I don't know if that what that makes you, but. Again, for those of you, if you're stumbling across this for the first time, you might be thinking, what did I fall into here? Basically, what we do is, probably like many of you, we spend time on Twitter every week. Also, probably like some of you, you're Christians, and we are Christians. And so we want to steward our time and basically redeem the time that we spend on Twitter. And so we basically find things on a variety of different topics that we think are interesting, that we think that there's some meat on the bone to talk about. Could be on a parenting front, could be on as husbands, as business owners, as just men in general. We just basically find stuff and then we bring them here and we kind of talk about them and we say, hey, Tim, what do you think about this? You're a pastor. What do you think about this? Jim, you're an entrepreneur. What do you think about this? We just kind of do that kind of stuff. So this is the more sanctified version of the All In podcast. That's kind of what our goal is. And so today, without further ado, we're going to launch in. Elon recently came out with a bonkers tweet. I know this is a shock to all of us. Elon's takes are normally fully hinged, and this one was far less so. Here we are. Elon, we will use Grok 3.5, maybe we should call it 4, which has advanced reasoning to rewrite the entire corpus of human knowledge, adding missing information and deleting errors, then retrain on that. Far too much garbage in any foundation model trained on uncorrected data. Now, there's a charitable way to read that in which, maybe that didn't sound like the worst thing ever. At the same time, there's a completely, slightly more dystopian take that wonders what on earth that might look like and what might, who are the people who are getting, who gets to be part of this ministry of truth that gets to decide what is actually real from history and what isn't, Jim? What are your thoughts when you read this insanity from Elon?
I mean, Elon said a lot of things that made sense to me in the past. He said that he wanted to do XAI because all of the mainline AI research labs like ChatGPT and OpenAI were woke.
Yeah.
So he wanted to create a maximum truth-seeking AI, which I like, but at the same time, this statement doesn't make any sense to me from an information theory standpoint. You can't synthesize information out of nothing. I mean, if it was something closer to, maybe this is what he meant. Maybe it's, we're going to curate the most logically consistent set of or subset of the information that's out there and just throw out the stuff that doesn't, it's like this doesn't belong. If there's 98% consensus on one thing, we're just going to throw out the other 2%. I mean, that could kind of make sense, but even then you get into trouble because it's like sometimes, especially in modern era, 98% of the stuff is the lie.
Yeah.
And so you throw out the signal, you know?
Yep. So yeah, again, the question that it begs is by what standard? What is the standard that we're going to use to determine truth? You know, like, and there's certain things that are more that are easier than others. But I mean, at the same time, oh, you're going to have people who are going to say, oh, well, science. It's like, well, no, all science has to be interpreted. There's always an interpretive grid. You know, if you're all data has to be interpreted, you can't, there's no one who just gets raw data and then can come to conclusions. By definition, conclusions require, you know, layers of interpretation. And so again, this is just part of what it is. You're going to have, at the end of the day, this process will involve having people who are, you know, basically deciding what, you know, they're weighting things. They're going to be doing a number of different things. And it's not going to be as simple as as just saying, we're going to find all the truth in ways that other things aren't. There's still a lot more questions here.
Well, Elon's also, I think he just had a tweet yesterday saying like physics is the ultimate arbiter of truth or something like that.
Yeah.
Which obviously from a secular humanist materialist standpoint, that's true. We know that God is the ultimate source of truth, but God created physics. So there is mm-hmm. some truth to the idea that from a first principles standpoint, you eventually get down to physics and you can't lie about it. So maybe part of what Elon's trying to do is creating things like Optimus robots that interact in the real world, and it gets down to some sort of ground truth because he has direct sensor input. But that still doesn't solve the problem of history. Like you can't, that only solves the problem going forward. And even then, it's like Elon basically saying, trust me, bro. So
yeah, this is a humongous issue. I think we've talked about this at several different points, but you know, one of the big issues that especially secular humanists have is we live in a world where if you're going to be a secular humanist, you're definitely going to focus on scientific data, measurable, all these kind of, this kind of evidence like that you're going to like that a lot. The problem is there's different standards of evidence for different fields. And so, yes, science, physics, all these things, that's a measurable, it's you're able to measure things within these fields. Unfortunately, history also has an evidentiary standard. It also has a standard of evidence by which you know things. The problem is it's very different than that of science. It's no less important. It's no less real, but it is very different. And so again, one example of this is there's no scientific way to prove that George Washington existed, right? Like he's like, you can't prove historical things scientifically. That doesn't work. So I mean, we can't prove Jesus existed scientifically. We have to move to...
Even in the case of science, they've been measuring things like the age of the universe and they keep revising it by billions of years, you know? And so it's just right.
And this is another thing. It's like all of these, the ways of knowing things is based on a presupposition that is unscientific. So for example, how do we know what we know? Well, scientifically, well, we have evidence. Well, okay. So how do we know, like what we can see is that the earth and the universe appears to be this age, according to, if we, you know, measure with whatever this dating standard is. And it's like, okay, well, how do we know that the standard by which we're using the standard, like our understanding of dating that works today has always been the case throughout all of human history. We can't demonstrate that because that's stuff that's outside of our purview. We don't have access to that. And so there's a limit to even the scientific knowledge and even the backward looking utility of even just looking at what we have right now. So there's a lot of assumptions that basically aren't acknowledged in a lot of ways when it comes down to science.
We're attempting to measure all this stuff from inside the system. I mean, the only person that can really be objective is the person that's outside the system.
Correct.
And I hate to be a spoiler alert here, but his name is God.
God, Jesus, and the Holy Spirit. There are three persons, one God and three persons. So technically there are three persons, Jim. Please don't deny Orthodox Presbyterian, especially.
You know, interestingly though, is Jesus inside the system? He was outside the system originally,
Yep.
Obviously, for a time, he was inside the system.
Is he back out? Is he back out?
I mean, he still has a real physical body, in my opinion, so it seems like he's probably somehow inside the system. Maybe 1 foot in, 1 foot out.
We're probably committing some sort of heresy. Well, I watched Tim with him. And, yeah, we get Tim here. This is a big, you know, again, this could, what Elon is describing is no different than what Sam Altman wants to do. And Sam Altman is far more willing to play ball with governments, seems to be far more willing to play ball with governments, far more willing to be much more craven and utilitarian than somebody like Elon. So I think there's reason to believe that this could go a lot better with Elon's Ministry of Truth than Sam's. But again, who knows? This is, it still is dystopian to think about.
At the end of the day, I don't think this is the right thing to be most concerned about by AI. So,
yeah. Okay. So yeah, that's another thing. It's like, it's even if this is true or is something that could be worried about, you know, who's setting the parameter, who's deciding what's the important things, who's deciding the weighting of the time and the allocation of resources and all that kind of stuff.
Just the idea that humans can control this thing is illogical to me. And so just the idea that they're going to be able to say what it thinks is going to be true, they can't, they don't have any control over that. I mean, obviously in the current level of systems, they can modify things, like they can modify the prompt before you put it in to get Black Drowning Fathers. But and I'm talking about once we get to super intelligence or whatever, there is no controlling it. It's like, even if you wanted to be Sam Altman and have it be the wokest of the woke AI, it's like you can't control that.
Yeah. Which again is really interesting, as people who, you know, Christians, we value the truth and we, you know, let the truth trips fall where they may. And so it's interesting to think about, like, what if we,
Well, that's what history's been, you know. Humans have been trying to control the narrative since the beginning of humanity.
Yep.
You know?
Exactly. Yeah.
So we can't. There's only one truth. It's the word.
Exactly. And he is a person. To that end, on that point, here we are. We have we gotta show this again. We have Dave Smith. I don't know how many of you are fans of Dave Smith. I've been a fan for a while. Dave Smith went on Tucker Carlson's show. And surprisingly, they talked about atheism. Jim, can you believe this? Dave Smith was an atheist, considered himself an atheist, at least an agnostic. And now Dave Smith has become a theist. Dave Smith believes in God. And he's going to talk about why that happened. So this isn't super long. I think it's like three minutes or something. So we'll listen to part of this and then we'll just cut it off. But here we go.
Stuff about me. I'm not even exactly sure who Sam Harris is, but sad atheist guy. But he describes you as a pure misinformation artist who lies as freely as he breathes. And I just thought, as I read this, you can say, you know, Dave Smith, I don't know, whatever, but I feel like that's the opposite of the truth. I feel like maybe you lie under duress, but in general, you are like very focused on what you think is true.
Well, I mean, again, I just feel like it's I benefit in a way from us having this conversation, like after COVID and after kind of all of these insane things that, okay, so Sam Harris, what did I get wrong? Like, I don't think that if you're going to smear me as being a misinformation artist, which I, you know, I'll take that I should make t-shirts about misinformation artist. Sorry, I'll take that.
Pure
misinformation.
Everything you say is a lie. It's like breathing to you.
Dude, I got called that throughout all of COVID, and I was right about everything I was saying. So keep calling me.
To the wrong place. Here we go.
Well, I mean, I would say that kind of ironically, although not really actually ironic, and this kind of goes to, you know, the conversation that you and Brett Weinstein were having the other day. I really love Brett. I think he's great. Yeah. I'm on your side of that debate. But I think one of the fundamental flaws in atheism is that it doesn't really exist.
Yes.
Now, they think that's the flaw in believing in God.
Oh, no.
They think the flaw in believing in God is that God really doesn't exist. God does exist. What doesn't exist are atheists. There's no such thing.
So true.
And you could even get into maybe if there was such thing as atheists, it would be a good thing to be one. But there aren't. They don't exist. They all have their religion. Mm. And it's almost by definition that whatever your highest thing is becomes your religion. I don't know if it's quite by definition. And I suppose it is theoretically possible to be an atheist, but almost no one ever is. And so what you're seeing is just that, you know, I'm attacking their religion. And according to them, that makes me guilty of blasphemy.
But it's just so interesting that they're so...
So yeah, we can just stop right here. I'm sorry for the wrong placement, but yeah, that's the idea. And so this is just so fascinating to hear old Dave Smith sitting here describing this. I think he's dead on and right. Like to quote Doug Wilson, it's never whether or not you're going to worship a god. It's which god are you going to worship? It's not whether, it's which. And so, like, Dave recognizing that even if you refuse to give mental assent, refuse to acknowledge belief in a deity, officially or something like that, there is something or someone, some entity to which you will give ultimate deference, you will trust more than any other. And so it's a hierarchical structure. And so everybody has somebody at the top of their hierarchy. Of trust, of loyalty, of, you know, whatever it is, you cannot escape that. And so to see somebody like Dave, who, again, by most people is known as, somebody who just wants to know the truth, is willing to admit when he's wrong about something, to hear him coming out with this I was, again, pleasantly surprised. So
to play the devil's advocate here for a second.
Do it.
I'm reminded of Romans 1. They worshiped and served the creature rather than the creator.
Mm-hmm.
I would say the hardline atheist probably would be very willing to draw that distinction.
Mm.
In other words, if they're worshiping the state, or if they're worshiping Bitcoin, or if they're worshiping themselves, like, yep, these are all creatures in a sense, things that, yep, were created. So I think the atheist would just say, yeah, but who cares? Because, like, I'm worshiping something that's inside the system. And so it's categorically different than your foolish opinion, which is you're worshiping something outside the system, which you have no way to prove exists. At least I'm worshiping things that I can prove exist, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
And so, yeah. So this, again, then we get down to back to epistemological questions of how do we know what we know? And so we would say, yeah, no, we do know real things. They just aren't things that are, that it has a different evidentiary standard. They're not proved the same way that, you know, your proof. So, like, the idea would be, if there is a god of the system, if there is a god who actually is outside of the system, can enter in anytime he wants to, who created the system, well, then there's no problem with the idea that God could reach in and communicate to his creatures, you know, through whatever means he wants to, including...
Well, I would argue this is why the incarnation is so important.
Yeah.
Because it's...
Yep.
It's really the only way that we as creatures... made in his image as human beings can fully and truly interact and relate to him.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously in the Old Testament, you've got Christophanies and burning bushes and,
yep,
things like that. But those are all shadows of what's to come eventually, yep, right? It's, yep, not fully realized until we see Jesus. And, yep, until we see Jesus, we can't fully understand it.
Yep. Yeah. For those who are watching, maybe who don't know. So incarnation just means the taking on. It's when Jesus took on a human body, took on flesh. And so carne, if you know a little bit of Spanish, that means, you know, meat or body, in this case. And so basically you have, you know, Jesus takes on a body. God doesn't just communicate information. He's not just content to, he does this in the beginning. He does send messages. He basically has information that he wants to communicate, but he always sends these via either angels or via people in the form of prophets. And so ultimately in the capstone of this revelation of God communicating what's called special revelation. So information about him and what he desires that can't be discovered by, you know, what would be called the book of nature, which is by, you can't learn things. There's certain things that you can't learn about God by just looking around at the world. And so God sends prophets including, again, ultimately Jesus, to communicate what he's like, what he wants, and to illustrate through their lives, what God desires. And so this is something that, again, requires it's gonna come from outside of you. It requires you to acknowledge it. This isn't something you're gonna come to the understanding of by yourself. It doesn't work that way.
I would say, though, to caveat that,
yeah,
I think you can. So everybody that is saved through Jesus, but mm-hmm. there's different levels of knowledge of yep. Jesus, right? So it's like Abraham is saved by faith. He knows that there's going to be a savior that comes. That's what his faith is in, and that's what is saving for him. I don't know if he knows explicitly that it's Jesus of Nazareth yeah. and he's going to be there at a certain date.
No. So yeah. Yeah, we don't think...
I think there's room for the Pacific Islander that only saw the stars and God sort of revealed in a more general way. I think it's theoretically possible for those people to be saved in the new heavens and the new earth.
Yeah. Interesting. I mean, that's a whole... We should do that topic at some point.
Well, I mean, this is the case for, like, aborted babies, right? Mm-hmm. Obviously, as an aborted baby, you die before you even are born. So there's no way you can know the name of Jesus.
Yep.
But it also seems to fit within God's character that he would save all those babies through faith in Jesus.
Correct.
So
Correct.
There is yeah, some way that can happen.
Yep. But again, this depends on who you ask, but there's vast majority of Christians who are alive right now, I think for most faith positions would agree. That would, again, reason, just like Jim did, that that babies who die prior to being born, or infants who die.
At the same time, though, as a Calvinist and a Presbyterian yeah. and a Reformed person that believes in double predestination, mm-hmm. it is totally within God's right to also damn said souls.
Yeah.
So, we can't fully plumb the depths of God and his Correct. Mercy and his justice, but we can trust in his promises and we can rest easy in that justice will be done and that he is merciful.
Yeah, that the judge of all the earth will do right. This is something, just the reality of how much do we really understand? Like, there's so many things that happen every day where my evaluation of their rightness or wrongness, their goodness or badness is totally wrong. Where I'll want something that I think is good to happen, or I don't want something that I think seems only categorically bad to happen. And then God just sees things differently. So
even just last week, we were at GA. Tim was not able to address the floor.
Yeah, why don't you kind of explain this? This is we were putting a ticket about this, but this is a good...
We can hit on it a little bit. Yeah. Yeah, we could come back and do it more fully when Tim's here, but I'll just give a high level. So Tim and I are ordained officers in the PCA. It's the Presbyterian Church in America. It's the more conservative Reformed split off of the original Presbyterian Church, which is now the PCUSA. So PCUSA is kind of the main line. PCA is the denomination that we're in. We meet once a year at General Assembly. It's called GA. It was in Chattanooga this year. The reason that we went and the reason that this GA was interesting was that there was an overture on the agenda, which is just a way to say we're asking the General Assembly to consider something and possibly do something. In this case, the overture was, hey, we think that it would be good and right for presbyteries, which is just groups of churches in a local area, and individual churches to study Bitcoin. That's not to say that we were forming a study committee. That's not to say that we were requiring anybody to study. It was just, hey, we think it would be good for you if you consider and study Bitcoin. When that overture came up, it was put into an omnibus, which was just it was grouped with a bunch of other overtures to vote them all in the favor of what the overtures committee recommended, which in this case was to vote that overture down. So it wasn't going to be a recommendation for churches and presbyteries to study. Tim stood up and asks, so anybody that's a voting member in this GA can pull one of the overtures out of omnibus. Then when it comes up for discussion, they set a 60-minute topic clock, and then you can stand up to one of six microphones, and each person that stands up gets 3 minutes to talk. Now, there's certain rules about how you can talk. Another gentleman stood up at microphone one. Tim was standing up at microphone four. the moderator happened to call on gentleman at microphone one. He moved the previous question, which just means, hey, I want to go ahead and just take this thing to a vote right now without any further discussion. So in typical Presbyterian fashion, since we're so orderly, we have to vote on whether or not we want to vote. So a vote was taken to move the previous question. It was answered in the affirmative. So then they actually voted on the overture itself, the original question, which was, should we recommend to study? And that got voted down. That all happened before Tim was able to give his speech. Tim had prepared a 3-minute speech, which had he been able to give it, we probably would not have, it would not have occurred to us to post it on Twitter. But now that it is a censored speech, we post it to Twitter and it ends up going viral. It got like 12,000 views in the first 24 hours, which is 6 times more people reading or hearing this speech than would have otherwise heard it in the General Assembly, which had 2,000 people in it. So in the moment, it felt kind of not great, but obviously the Lord had his own plan for it to get that speech out there.
Again, as sunny as that is, impressions aren't views, as anyone who's paying for ads on Twitter will tell you. But again, with that being said, again, and also these 2,000 people will have the voting power for, you know, representing hundreds of thousands of people. But with that
for
being
sure, I think there was an aspect, though, that because it was censored, people wanted to read it. You know what I mean?
Sure. Could be. So anyhow, so that didn't get to go forward. Tim did say he explained this in a text group that we're in and basically said, that might turn out to be the costliest mistake in the history of the Presbyterian Church.
Yeah. So we posted up, there's an expo hall at GA, which even if you're not a PCA or Presbyterian, it's totally a raucous thing to come to if you're a Christian. I highly recommend coming.
Whoa, wait, raucous. Wait a second.
Hang on.
Raucous might be a strong word.
I know you weren't there, but I'm just saying, opening night worship, there was like 5,000 people in this room, most of whom are men, and they had a full orchestra. And it was like, I mean, I'm telling you, it's one of the closest feelings I've gotten to being in heaven. Like, it's just listening to everybody busting out the hymns and
Totally granted. I'm not saying it was not incredible. The word raucous, I don't think the word raucous has ever been used in corresponding with a GA in the history of Presbyterianism. So
we're a little buttoned up. Sometimes they call us the frozen chosen, but man, people were belting it out. Anyways, there was an expo hall. We had a booth there. We're going to be posted up there next year as well. You should come by, just participate in the worship, go to the expo. There's a lot of families there. People bring their kids. We got a lot of super positive feedback at the booth as well, and made a lot of great connections. And I think ultimately it's God will redeem the work that we're doing there.
Amen. And Lord willing, I'll be there next year. I wasn't able to be there because I was with my kids at music camp. We were at basically learning how to sing in parts and do all kinds of fun stuff. So we couldn't make it. We will. It looks like I was just talking to Stan Reeves. It looks like TGFB will be represented at the Founders Conference, which I believe is in January or February of this coming year. Stan and I are going to be representing TGFB, be there, have a booth. So if you're going to be there, we'd love to, again, similar to the GA thing, we'd love to have you come over and chat and bring all of your salty no-coiner friends, and we'll be happy to orange pill the living daylights out of them.
We're going to try and go to the SBC one next year too. I think it's going to be in Orlando, but then ours is in Louisville in June. So you can also turn that into an Ark excursion. They've built the replica of the Ark, which actually we happen to be going to in October. My mom wanted to take the grandkids. So we're going there in October, but we may end up going back. So it's not that far from Louisville if you want to go down there and check it out.
Okay. Well, cool. Yeah, do that. That'll be fun. All right, we're going to move along here. We've got, let's see, David Perel. I don't know if you're familiar with him. This is not Perel of the hand soap, at least that I'm, I know of. David Perel is known for, let's see if this pops up here. There you go. So the writing guy, he's a Christian. Grew up Jewish, and then became a Christian a number of years ago. He has done a number of things to help people learn to be better writers. I actually took one of his courses about a year ago. was thoroughly enjoyed it. I actually need to get on there and share with people. They have like an online community where I can just share about the Orange Umbrella, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But so David has, he's one of the best followers in social media. Go get him. He's a super thoughtful guy. He said this, calling it now, the swing away from optimization culture is going to be one of the bigger trends of the next decade. Now, this might seem like you might be thinking, what in the world is optimization culture? It's the culture of just making things as efficient as possible. Okay, so an example of this would be something like, I don't know if there's any NBA or sports fans who are listening to this, but one example of this would be the trend in the NBA, where you've seen a move in the last probably 10 years to where more and more teams are shooting more and more three-point baskets. Because if you do the math on, you know, the expected point value for shooting three-pointers versus shooting two-pointers, you're almost always better to just shoot as many threes as possible, which, again, it makes sense mathematically, but it's horrible to watch. And so that adds, you know, a component to this. And the same is true of, you know, the same thing has happened to lesser degrees in football, baseball. Baseball, it was one of the places it really started, the whole Moneyball phenomenon. So again, you just have, it's things where it's like higher, the heights are higher. So everyone in baseball right now is trying to hit home runs. So you either hitting home runs or you're striking out. That's a lot more, it's kind of an all or nothing proposition, less middle class at bats, if you will. And so this is one of these things. So he's saying the same thing is happening, technologically in a number of different fronts. And so he's just basically saying, we're going to get to the point where we just realize that just living for the most efficient way to do things according to one measure, we're just going to get sick of it. And people are going to start going away from it in favor of other things that maybe are at least nominally less efficient, but a better and more healthy experience overall. Jim, I don't know if you have anything to add to this one, but.
Yeah. I mean, you could argue from a money standpoint that people do it in a sort of shrinkflation kind of way, right? Mm-hmm. You're trying to get things for as cheap as possible because you're trying to make your dollar stretch further because it's been debased.
Yep.
And maybe he's saying this because Bitcoin's going to fix that, or does he say why he thinks this is happening?
No, I think it's more, at least again, knowing him a little bit, like my I think he's just thinking from a standpoint of like this efficiency that's being sought after, it's monetary efficiency or time efficiency. And so like that, it makes sense to a point, but there comes to like there's like a tipping point where the human, one of the things that I've talked about before in some capacity is like efficiency is a means to an end. There is a type of efficiency that is actually godless and anti-human. I think that's what he's getting at is like, there is an optimization. There's a level of optimization and a type of optimization that's actually anti-human and unhelpful in the grand scheme of things. And so I think he's just basically saying we've kind of reached the tipping point where, you know, we've seen all this optimization that, you know, we're going to see. And now people are starting to recognize, wait, this actually costs me on a number. If you're denominating the cost in human experience or whatever it would be, relationships, whatever it is, there's a number of other ways that you could denominate optimization. And according to those things, where we're at is not enjoyable. It's not actually healthy for the long term. So I think that's kind of what he's getting at.
Yeah. I mean, I personally went through this myself. I used to do like software consulting by the hour.
Yeah.
And then I kind of went away from that because it was almost like the way that you're measuring it incentivizes you to act in a certain way. It was all about spend the maximum number of hours, especially when I was working at home. It was always like, well, you know, I could go mow my yard or I could pay a yard guy way less per hour than I can make if I just walk down into my office.
Yeah.
And so I ended up making all these decisions that at the end of the day weren't great in the long term for my soul or the souls of my family members.
Yeah.
So I think we do have to be careful, especially as Christians, about how we set up our lives and the incentives that it creates for us.
Mm.
So I think it's different for everybody. Like, we all have different temptations that we give into more easily.
Sure.
So for me, it was just being a workaholic. So,
I'm gonna see if we can get David on the podcast. David is let's see how many followers David have here. Let's see. He's got a bunch. 461,000. Yeah, he's a really respected dude. He's interviewed a ton of really important people. His company was called Rite of Passage. It looks like he's disassociated himself with it. But go find his YouTube channel. Look him up on YouTube. He's interviewed a bunch of good people. Let's stop sharing that. Let's move on here. Here we are. This is about Jim's favorite topic, which is AI. Jim is a humongous fan of vibe coding, his life. And so we're going to take a peek at this one here.
Just a huge fan of AI.
All right, here we go.
Try this. Ask it to draw a picture of a group of watches showing 3 minutes after 12. Okay, so the minute hand and the hour hand are very close together. What you will get is 10 after 10. And if you try to do 6:28, where the hands are very close together, you'll get 10 after 10 again. And the reason for this is that the pictures of clocks and watches on the web are dominated by 10 after 10 because it's the most attractive look. Everybody in OpenAI knows about this, and they have been unable to.
Really? That's crazy. That's what you're saying.
This is a widespread example. The thing they use to deal with problems like this is called reinforcement training, but the reinforcement training hasn't worked, probably because there are too many times other than 10 after 10 that would have to be reinforced. I'll give you a second example. Ask ChatGPT to draw a picture of somebody writing with their left hand. You always get a right hand. I tried various tricks to get it to do a left hand. I've been able to get it to do a left hand, but it's not been easy.
Mm.
Elon's going to fix this.
Yeah. This brings to mind those great philosophers of yore, namely the band Me Without You. I don't know if any of you are familiar with Me Without You. They were like a spoken word kind of post rock kind of real whole interesting band of my youth. But they have this famous song where they utter the phrase, "A glass can only spill what it contains." And so that's really kind of what's being described here is, you know, AI is really just data compression. It's just taking what it has, taking the raw materials it has and using that. And so if you have a dominating percentage of images, in the case of the watches, where they're showing one time, to try to get it to show another time is just not as easy as, you know, it's just not very simple because it's drawing on what it has. You can only, you can't make an apple pie from potatoes. It doesn't work.
Do you think that's true of humans?
From what standpoint?
We can only spill what's inside of us. Like, I don't know. Einstein comes up with the theory of relativity. Did that come from outside of him?
I think it would depend on, I think from the standpoint of out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. I think that that kind of thing, it's true of that. Whether it's true of information, I wouldn't say that. I would say information comes from God. And so like that comes from like, I think reason is, I don't think that. Everyone knows like reason is, every Christian would say reason is a gift from God. It's divinely inspired. It's given to us by God. So I don't think I wouldn't say it comes from us.
When Einstein thinks up the theory of relativity, it's sure. Like, is it an invention or is it a discovery? And does he discover it via reason or does he discover it just via pattern matching with information that he's already consumed previously? And is there a difference between the two? You know, this is like the classic processor versus memory debate in computer science. You know, you can save on memory by having to reprocess it and come up with the answer again, or you can pre-compute the answers and put them in memory and then it saves you on CPU time later.
Yep.
So I guess somehow being a human, I feel like we're special and our minds are doing something that is beyond what's just measurable in the physical world.
Yeah.
Maybe even to the extent of tapping into the divine. Like that's what part separates us from the animals.
Yep.
Just thinking to like the idea of Adam in the garden and the Lord giving him the task of naming everything.
Yeah.
Like where do those names come from? You know?
Yep. Yep.
So
yeah, it is fascinating. I mean, there's number, I think we've talked about this too. It's like, there's a number of examples where like the Apostle Paul, he says, he describes sinful humanity as, he says like unreasoning animals, they do whatever they do. And so he is using reason as the thing that distinguishes between man and animals. When Israel, as one example, is in sin in the Old Testament, God says to them, come, let us reason together. He's basically appealing to them to use and steward their reasoning faculties faithfully to see, you know, see the consequences of what they're doing.
Well, these latest LLMs, they claim are reasoning models now, you know, and they have a new button like Grok. You can click the button that shows you its chain of reasoning to how it got to its answer, which is, you know, they're trying to like reclaim that for the LLMs and not just, it's like, more than humans, other things can reason besides just humans is kind of what they're saying, which I don't know if I buy into it.
Yeah, it's a good marketing gimmick.
But yeah.
Whether or not it's actually true, that's remains to be seen. All right, here we go. Pleditor, that great tweeter of yore. Let's see here. 29K followers. How am I not following Pleditor? He shared this video from David Sachs. Here we go. Let's see what David has to say.
Not pass on interest.
Why?
To the token holders.
Why is that?
Look, I mean, I don't know if there's a great principled reason. This was a compromise that was necessary to get the support of the banking industry, quite frankly.
Ah, they see it as competition, I'm betting.
Well, there was a lot of concern from community banks that if stablecoins were paying 5% interest, it would put them out of business. I personally think that concern, although understandable from them, I don't think that's what would have happened. But these are the types of compromises, quite frankly, that you need in order to pass legislation. I hope that at some point in the future, we'll revisit that and allow stablecoin issuers to kind of just do what they want to do.
Okay.
And that'll be easier once the banks get into the act and they're participating in this industry.
Got it.
But right now, they're total outsiders and you can understand the fear factor.
All right, Sachs.
Is that stablecoin issuers?
Jim, do you want to kind of unpack this maybe for people who don't get it?
Yeah. So there's legislation going on right now in the Genius Act that regulates stablecoins. Stablecoins are things like Tether, which is essentially just a company that creates a cryptocurrency that trades at $1 par. Like, it doesn't really go up and down. I mean, sometimes it goes up and down a little bit, but the way that they do this is when you put money into and you buy Tethers, they mint new Tether tokens, and then they back each one of those tokens by a treasury, essentially. And so their business model is, I mean, before they weren't paying interest. I guess they were trying to pay interest, or they are paying interest, but their business model was you just get dollar exposure because you live in Argentina and you're not allowed to buy dollars. And then
you just don't have access to it.
You don't have access to it. We make all the interest off the treasuries. And so that's their profit, I guess. Maybe they're trying to pass through some of that back to their customers to offer them a yield to convince them to buy Tether versus other stable coins. The banks don't like this, of course, because now it's competing with a CD or a high yield savings account.
And competing directly with them for attention and for investment capital. Like, if you have people who are storing money with Tether or with Circle or whatever they're doing, then they're not storing it with these other banks. And so as part of their condition for their support, the bank said, hey, yeah, you guys can, we could pass this. You guys can still exist, but you're not going to be able to, you know, to pay out these effectively, this interest for holding Tether. Like, let's say if you're holding $50,000 worth of Tether, you're not going to be able to Tether. You're not going to be able to pay out interest to these guys, but we are. It's kind of,
I think it's pretty clear that we're moving into a world where banks are going to custody Bitcoin.
Oh yeah, definitely.
But
yeah.
I think the more interesting question is kind of like MicroStrategy got out of the gate first and they have a massive first mover advantage with being a Bitcoin treasury company. Does Tether have a first mover advantage with being
for stablecoin?
I mean, I guess you can argue that like CDs at a bank are kind of like a stablecoin. So Tether is famously one of the most profitable, or like the most profitable company per employee. They literally just print money. It's insane how much money they're printing. And they've turned around and put all of that back into Bitcoin now, essentially with, what's this company, 21 yep. Capital or whatever. They've yep. funded it with like $100 billion worth of Bitcoin, I think. Is it 100,000 Bitcoin that they're putting in?
I don't know. It was a lot.
Yeah, it's insane. So the alternate take is the Adam Livingston tweet.
What did you say
on Signal?
Oh, on Signal. Okay, all right, yeah. We talked about doing that beforehand, then we...
Yeah, so...
It's based on it.
Adam's take is that...
hold on here.
Tether is essentially the Trojan horse that's going to usher in the flippening between Bitcoin and the dollar. So what's interesting, right, is as Tether rolls more of the interest from the bonds into Bitcoin and the value of the Bitcoin goes up, the question becomes, at what point does their Bitcoin holdings, which kind of makes them look like a Bitcoin treasury company, become more valuable than the bond holdings that represent the dollar backing for the stablecoin? Like, when that happens, then the question becomes, well, why is the token being backed by the weaker currency mm-hmm. or the thing that's smaller on the balance sheet? So he argues that what you may end up seeing is Tether actually trading at a premium like 1.2 or 1.5 yep. instead of one, which is what yep. it should be. That's what it was supposed to be. And when that starts happening, it sort of turns into a runaway train and accelerates the flippening. So, you know, and everybody in the government's...
This train, Jim. Nothing stops this train.
He's just arguing that the government's being all chum-chum with these stablecoin providers because they think it's going to keep dollar hegemony going, but it actually accelerates the transition to the Bitcoin standard, which ultimately in the end is the demise of the dollar.
Yeah, so this is... I mean, here's the thread. Just basically exactly what Jim laid out. I'll let you guys find this. What we should do.
He's got a video version of it too. Oh, at the bottom. Yeah. Cool. But his videos, he talks really fast and uses really colorful analogies that are hard to understand. So,
okay. Is that, right here. There you go. Okay.
Yeah.
And who does he work for? Is it
he wrote a book,
for the Smarter Web company? No.
No. He just came on Twitter like a couple months ago and he's already almost 50,000 followers or something. It's like,
guys, let me translate what that means. What Jim is saying is he's accusing Adam Livingston of being a spook. I'm pretty sure that's what's going on. It's like Jason Lowry. He appeared out of nowhere.
Yeah. No, he's real.
Yeah. No, I'm just kidding. Adam was the one who recommended the Smarter Web company as like the Bitcoin treasury company. He just basically said they're going to be the next one. And then they exploded and now they've shrunk back down, much to Jim's chagrin. And now, who knows what's going to happen, in the future, but, all right, let's keep going on here. Speaking of making products out of Bitcoin or products that are offered for Bitcoin, we have this one right here. All right. So from Gilded Pleb, friend of the program, future and former guest. Why isn't this working? There we go. He's talking about what CJ Constantinos, basically his new business, People's Reserve, which basically offers Bitcoin-backed mortgages, at least nominally. Well, it looks like when you dig down into how that actually works out and how they're choosing to do that, apparently they have an ERC-20 ICO token, an ERC-20 token, basically token built on Ethereum that you can buy to give you preferred lending rates, something to that effect. So Gilded Pleb basically asks these questions. Here he goes. How is this not an ICO? That coin, Sally, circa 2017. It seems pretty very similar to it. Whose idea was this? CJ has been on some of the largest Bitcoin podcasts. I've communicated with CJ, had no idea that this was going to be part of their business model. He's been on Preston Pish's podcast, friend of the program, Preston Pish. Been on, I believe, Jimmy's podcast. He's been on some of the biggest podcasts in all of the biggest Bitcoin podcasts. I don't think anybody knew that this was going to be part of the thing. How is this Bitcoin maximalism? I don't think it is. Why do you do this at all? That's a great question. What is the purpose? I think it's just to allow them to make more money.
Back up.
Go for it.
So the mortgage is still backed by Bitcoin, but you're buying down the rate by holding an ERC-20 token in their custody?
I think that's the idea. Because like there's a sale for these tokens, tiered stages that they're offering these things. So to qualify for Diamond, which is a certain mortgage rate or something, you have to own a certain percentage.
Yeah. So they're giving you a discounted rate, but then they're turning around probably and taking that token and yield farming on it to make it up.
Potentially. Yeah. We don't want to accuse without knowing, but it's definitely certain that there's an Ethereum token involved in this thing, which just really surprises me.
I don't know what to say. If you're creating a product and targeting Bitcoin maximalists, you just shot yourself in the foot.
So. Yeah, it just doesn't make sense to me. But I mean, I'm sure there'll be people who are out there who take advantage of this. There's obviously humongous demand for, for Bitcoin mortgage products. I just don't.
Well, that story just came out a couple of days ago, right? Like they're recommending that banks take Bitcoin as collateral.
Oh yeah,
mortgages.
Yeah. Pulte came out and was talking about that.
Yeah,
yeah. Who reached out to him? I can't remember who it was, but
I mean, if that actually plays out, I'm ecstatic about that.
100%.
Being able to collateralize your mortgage with Bitcoin that you're already just holding in self-custody for forever. I mean, no brainer.
Well, and then there's other ways to do this too. Like there's other ways to make this happen. I mean, there's like, I'm trying to think of, I can't remember what the other, like proof of funds. There's somebody who just was on Marty Bent's podcast and they were talking about this. I can't think of what the guy's name is.
I saw that somebody linked to that product. I'll be curious to see how they actually do it.
Yep.
Or if it can only be in like an unchained vault or something. Or
yep. And then you've also got friend of the program, Rob Hamilton, who does Anchor Watch, which is like Bitcoin insurance, and uses Miniscript. And there's some interesting things that you can potentially do to this end, to kind of give proof of funds while still maintaining custody. So again, you want to get the benefit of both worlds if possible. And man, sadly, this does not seem like it's going to be something that I'm interested in using, and that I know a lot of Bitcoin people are going to be willing to use. Given,
well, it seems like a double whammy, because not only are they shooting themselves in the foot, but supposedly normal banks are going to be hot on the heels just taking Bitcoin as collateral anyways. So
yeah,
it's like, what's the incentive to go with these guys?
Exactly. If you're competing against somebody in, you know. Yeah, I just don't see how this helps them at all.
I'm willing to hear them out, but sure. It definitely feels slimy.
Yeah, moving on. We are, we've got, let's see, this is Matthew Cratter. Hopefully we're going to get Matt on the program. I reached out to him. We have some friends in common. And so hopefully we're going to do this. This is humongous news that people just kind of move past pretty quickly. The ECB coming for your money. Again, we won't watch this 11-minute and 35-second video, but basically, you have convicted criminal Christine Lagarde, who's the chief of the European Central Bank, who is basically talking about doing a bail-in and just taking customer deposits in order, basically as a loan, and then paying them out for it, and paying them some sort of return. This is insane. Just absolutely atrocious. This has happened other places, and just the fact that they're trying, you know, just openly talking about this is utterly unhinged and an argument and reason, reason Bitcoin exists and an argument for Bitcoin if I've ever heard one.
Well, this was the whole Keynesian trope to begin with, right? Keynes was saying, oh, we have to have inflation to incentivize people to spend, otherwise the economy will grind to a halt. And so they're basically just parroting, hey, savings are bad, essentially. You guys are horrible for our economy by hoarding your money. We need to essentially steal your money so that we can, quote, reinvest it. But we know that's not what's happening. They're just spending it on government programs that don't add any value to the economy.
Exactly.
I think what the question I have is, why don't they just keep printing money? Like, why do they need to steal people's balances when they can just run the money printer? Other than just, they know that's inflationary. And yeah, so they're already doing that. And yeah. So it's like, it's not that they're not, it's let's do both.
Yeah. It's that again, you basically stealing other people's money allows you to continue to do the money printing without it being, you know, having
as inflationary.
Correct. It just heightens it rather than it being something that is or isn't happening.
Yeah. Which, you know, effectively one way to think about this is their bond sales are going no bid. And so
that's why
this is effectively, we're forcing you to bid on our bonds.
Yes. Yeah. That's basically what this is. They're basically forcing you to lend them money at a return. They're forcing you to buy their bonds.
Well, yeah. Which is just a bond. I mean, that's what it is.
Yes, exactly. And so again, this is an argument for Bitcoin if there ever was one. This is now again, to paint this in Christian parlance, this is an attempt to deny sowing and reaping. The European Central Bank wants to have the benefits of their citizenry trusting them and lending them money, despite the fact that they, because of their poor stewardship, no one trusts them and nobody wants to lend them money. They're trying to get the benefit without undertaking the self-control that would be required to get this in a licit, normal way. And so
we have to work our butts off to get a high credit score to be eligible to get loans.
100%.
And exactly. they don't have to do anything.
No, they can just steal your money, literally steal your money. That's literally what they're throwing out there, as if this is totally normal and you're just a hater and a conspiracy theorist if you object to this in any way. So
well, you're
my girl. Okay.
You're anti-European Union. You're against growth. You're against all the good stuff we're trying to do to help the environment and keep our companies competitive in the global landscape and all the things they say, you know? Yeah. And what's sad is that there's probably a lot of people in Europe that totally buy the line.
Yeah. It's these people are liars. They are absolutely liars who, again, Christine, she's a convicted criminal. She's a convicted felon. She got out of jail. And they literally put her back in the role. Like, what in the world? If this were to happen anywhere else, we'd be getting all kinds of... If you made her the CEO of DroneLink, Jim, again, you'd be getting looked at. Nobody would trust you. It'd be like, why is Jim... why does Jim value the skills, the very particular set of skills that Christine Lagarde has? What does she have to contribute? And the reality is she's good at doing this kind of thing. And she's willing to do horribly immoral things for the right amount of money, which is what the European Central Bank is willing to pay her. So go watch this. Matthew Crater is the man. Again, we're trying to get him on the podcast here soon. And as soon as we get more information about that, we will let you know. Here we go. Jake Gosselin, friend of the program. Share this tab.
Jake, last one.
We've got a couple more, but we're not far. Jake Gosselin, he's the founder of Real Church Front. Basically, he helps basically mega churches set up basically sound systems and visual things and all kinds of stuff. Jake's a good dude. He has a YouTube channel, does Bitcoin videos as well. But he posted this the other day. Bitcoiners get it. Church leaders and pastors don't. This is very sad. This is from Jack Mallers speaking at Bitcoin Prague. The control and issuance of money are first and foremost ethical questions. It's not an economic problem. It's a moral one. This is something that we literally beat our heads against the wall to try to help people understand this question of the ethics of money production. This is not some, we should not just leave this to economists, to central bankers. This is a very, at the end of the day, ethical, moral concern to which Christians of all people and pastors should be speaking to. they should be talking about the underlying moral, ethical, biblical issues that are undergirding government actions. And perhaps no one has better illustrated this than somebody like Nicholas Aresme, who is a 15th century bishop. Jörg Guido Holzmann wrote the book, The Ethics of Money Production, based on primarily Nicholas Aresme's work. And he was basically this bishop who objected to somewhere in Europe. Somebody, one of these princes of this nation was basically introducing baser metals into the monetary supply to be able to create more currency units and enrich himself. And Nicholas Aresme, a bishop, confronted him and basically said, "Sir, you're violating this obscure Old Testament passage known as the Eighth Commandment. you're stealing from your citizenry and it's wrong. It's not just less than ideal. This is sinful and wrong." And so good on Jack, our man in Chicago, for speaking in these terms. And again, hopefully this will be something that, you know, again, more and more of us can raise, an issue that we can raise with church leaders to help them see the reality of what's undergirding this issue.
I think that framing it in the ethics of money production is the critical point there. I think a lot of Christians would be quick to admit that, yeah, there's a lot of ethics around money, but they usually think about it in terms of using the money and consuming the money. And like the avarice and the greed and all the pitfalls.
Money with prostitutes is bad. Everyone would acknowledge. Yeah.
So they just spend 99.9% of the airtime on the ethics of that side of money. And then the production side just gets a total pass for some reason.
Yes. Yeah. We'll just let governments positivistically just decide whatever they want to do in terms of.
I mean, probably the average Christian, if you ask them, "Hey, is 2% inflation good?" It's a, "Well, yeah, because that's what the Fed says."
Mm. Yeah. All right, here we go. We're going to move. Let's see. We got one more here. We'll save this good one. We'll save the spiciest one. We'll save this one for Tim when he's
back. We're holding out.
Yeah. This is it. And what I'm referring to is Peter Thiel's interview with Ross Douthat. We may have to watch the whole thing because it's just so good. It's so wild and unhinged that it might be worth doing a full watch along. That'll be fun. But to finish here, we have Stefan Molyneux. He is like a internet personality, provocateur. He's had YouTube channel for a long time, 422,000 followers. He's a brilliant guy. Again, I definitely not a Christian. He's kind of more of a, I don't think he's an atheist, but like agnostic. Other than that, I mean, there's tons of things where he's just a very brilliant mind and able to parse things and the logic of things very clearly. So we have Diego Trombone repeating something that we hear a lot in Bitcoin, that what's the actual phrase? Bad men create hard times, that whole idea. I can't remember what
bad men create hard times, hard times create strong men.
Strong men. Yeah. The whole dichotomy of strong men and hard times and easy times and weak men, that whole thing. And so we have this Diego Trombone saying, "It'd be like that. Hard times are created by weak men who let women lead." This is big if true, and it's been true since Genesis 3, so we would agree. And then Stefan responds to that and says, "The strong men were wiped out by World War I, and governments bribed women with the vote to keep the peace. So women turn to the government instead of husbands and children for income and security." This is talking about in the aftermath of World War II. This is a very fascinating way to think about, you know, the dynamic of what's happened over the past century. Again, if you think about, I mentioned this in the group chat that we're in. If you think about the incentives, one of the established things is that governments frequently, when they get to the point where they've run up significant debts, they go to war to basically print money and inflate away these debts. And so the idea of, you know, entering into war, at least the possibility of entering into war, both to inflate away your debts and to potentially, you know, use your strong men as cannon fodder to fight them. And then the result is you're left with less men and potentially a weaker populace, a populace that's weaker and less able to resist whatever insane thing that governments want to do. or whatever, you know, totalitarian thing that the government's wanted to do. It's just, it's a very, I've never thought about it that, to that degree. But when you think about the incentives that are there, that is a heck of an incentive alignment, to continue to do that over time. So, I just thought that was interesting. Anything you want to add there, Jim?
Yeah, I would, from a theological standpoint, I'd probably change the word bribed to tempted. I'm not sure if I would agree with the keep the peace aspect of that. Obviously, we've kind of had forever wars, so there hasn't really been peace. Maybe they're talking about peace kind of like internally within our society, not externally.
Correct. That's.
Yeah. But yeah, government's tempting women with the vote, in a sense, playing into what you mentioned there and their curse, their desire will be for your husband.
Yep.
What it's talking about is to usurp his
correct
God-given role of leadership. You know, I think that it didn't take much to tempt women into that. And obviously there's been hundreds and even thousands of years of just atrocities of men committing horrible acts of violence 100%. Against yeah. women. And so yeah. I'm not excusing any of that. That's men not living out their God-given role to lay down their lives for their wives, you know, and serve them just like Christ served the church. So, it is a sad state of affairs that we've gotten ourselves into. And I think, a lot of men have become, you've been told that masculinity is a bad thing. So
yeah,
we need strong men. We need strong women too.
Amen. Yeah. We need people to seek out and then to be content in the roles that they, you know, that God has given them. Just to act like any men using authority and being comfortable with authority is illicit, is insane and ahistorical and, you know, creates a situation where awful, strong men are able to rise up and do horrible things.
Just the whole gender war thing in the first place is a twisting by Satan. There's a absolutely amazing section of the second book in C.S. Lewis Space Trilogy. It's Paralandra, where they kind of get taken up to this cosmic heavenly dance between the Oarsas that are like the angels that protect the different planets. And there's a whole description. I'll have to pull the section out. I'll send it to you. But it's a whole description around the masculine and the feminine. Kind of Ransom, who's the main character, sort of has the wool pulled back from his eyes and sort of sees the true versions of these things that are kind of behind the scenes, the full vivid in color version of them that we will see once we get to heaven. You know, C.S. Lewis has kind of described heaven as sort of finally seeing things in color for the first time. And like the full expression of what those things actually are, and by comparison, how much they've been twisted. And this was like C.S. Lewis writing about this back in the 40s or 50s, right? Super prescient. So I think that's another example of just like, we're, as human beings, we're tapping into something that's not just in here, you know? You're muted.
We've talked about this before, but logic is a time machine. Logic allows you to see the future, and you know, there's very few people who embodied that as accurately as C.S. Lewis, man. There's so many things he might as well have been writing yesterday. It's wild. Chesterton's another one. There's just many guys who, again, when you tap into reality and you see it, you know, as God created it, it's amazing what you can articulate even hundreds of years separated from from present day. With that, we will come to an end. Last thing we're going to show here, again, just for by way of reminder, we have the Orange Umbrella. We are 11 days out from the end. We have 95 backers, $10,304 raised of our $12,500 goal. I am super encouraged by that. If you are basically, many of you have already, I would imagine, have already supported. Again, we would love for you to share this with your friends. This is a great resource, even if for people who aren't into Bitcoin or don't know about Bitcoin. We don't mention the B word in this book. It's just a great kids book. It's a great thing that you can give as a gift to, you know, covertly orange peel people. You know, just you can be doing it secretly. We have some different bundle packs. There's one where it's got, I think.
You got inscriptions, right? You can buy an inscription.
Yep, you could buy an inscription. Yeah, oh my gosh. We had somebody concerned that we were actually doing like Bitcoin inscriptions. All we meant is we're willing to sign it. Every copy gets signed. Every copy. An actual inscription to Jim. Please sell all of your ETH. You know, that kind of inscription. But we do have some sections. Let's see, where's our rewards here? There's a couple versions where... we have the Gould pack, which includes one premium legacy edition, super premium, you know, boards and paper and all that kind of stuff. And then 10 founder head covers, hard covers, not head covers. And then we have another one that includes, I believe it's, is it 20? I can't remember how much.
I just have to laugh. Every time I see the Gould pack, did you ever watch Stargate SG-1?
No, I did not.
Dude. The little like alien symbiotes that take over people's brains are called Goa'ulds.
Oh, yeah. Here we go. This is the. Oh shoot! It didn't show it. Anyhow, we do have the. It just disappeared. Where'd that go? I have a little bug. I have the no free ads, but we have the opportunity cost add-on, and so that's displaying the SAT value of all these things.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Can you put that in sailor mode?
Oh, yeah, I totally will do it. Let's see. You have it? Yeah, here it is. Okay. I put it in sailor mode the other day. If you don't know what sailor mode is, it basically displays what the value will be of whatever thing it's showing the price of when Bitcoin's at $21 million. So let's turn this on here and we'll see. So effectively, we are trying to raise $2.39 million worth of Bitcoin. And let's see if we can see some of these things. Yeah. So this 11 book pack, the Gould pack, that'll be worth $65,000, almost $66,000 worth of Bitcoin with Bitcoin at $21 million. So with that being said, ignore all that. Don't turn on sailor mode. Run over to Kickstarter.
Just buy and replace. Buy and replace.
Exactly. Kickstarter.com/projects/TGFB, the Orange Umbrella book. Just search for the Orange Umbrella. You'll be able to find it. Get us over this 12,500 so we can get these out. We can give these books to our kids, put them in their hands, help them learn good things about Bitcoin. Again, we'd really appreciate that. And with that said, Jim, any final words? I'll give you the last words here.
You know, I would say keep searching for the truth.
Mm.
You're a Bitcoiner and you're out there. You're not far from the kingdom. We can help.
Amen. We would love to chat. Hit us up in DMs. We actually do this. We get people who hit us up and ask us questions pretty regularly. So
Tim is actually hosting a salon. I don't know what we want to call it. He's going to be in Austin in August. So if you're a Bitcoiner and you're Jesus curious, he's going to be hosting a theological debate with some Bitcoin OGs down there. So definitely, if you're interested in that, reach out.
What? Can we get a little more information here? Or like, what's such a thing?
I'm not sure how much we can say yet, but okay. Definitely, if you're interested, just reach out to us and we can get you more details. We'll see if we can talk about it publicly next week.
Oh, let's go. I like this. Okay. All right. Well, that does it for episode 17 of To the Unknown Pod, which is really like episode... If I think it's 59 or 60 of the TGFB pod. So this is like a sub series. Don't ask questions. We're vibe coding it, much to Jim's chagrin. We are grateful for you guys. If you guys like what you're hearing, then reach out on, leave us a review, subscribe and like on YouTube, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify. Those are the ones that matter. If you get, if we get reviews and we get subscriptions on those places, those make the biggest impact. On top of that, we changed our podcast hosting to fountain.fm. If you are listening to this and you are a podcaster, you should be going and doing likewise. These guys are Bitcoiners. They're doing lots of great work. They have a great product. So go switch it over. They allow you to basically bring Patreon-esque services. People can sign up to, you know, give monthly or, you know, get a monthly subscription. You can also stream sats in real time. So go find out what they're doing. We really appreciate them. I had a call with their CEO, and I think they're both of the founders, UK-based guys, and they're doing really good work. So if you're a podcast and you're out there already spending money for web or for podcast hosting, go put it in the hands of Bitcoiners. So again, grateful for you guys. We will see you on the next episode of To the Unknown Pod. We'll be back on, I believe, on Tuesday with should be the Island Boys, and we'll look forward to seeing you.